Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. I'm Janice McDonald. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. Today, I'm super excited to welcome Vicky Hayman. She's a philanthropist, a community activist, an influential American cultural representative, and author of the just-released book, The Art of Diplomacy, which she co-wrote with her husband, former USA Ambassador to Canada, Bruce Hayman. Welcome to the show, Vicky.
Thank you so much, Janice. It's great to be on the show. Appreciate it.
We miss you in Ottawa.
Thank you. Yeah, I miss Ottawa.
So, and also welcome to our listeners from around the world, including UK, USA, Australia, New Zealand, and so many more countries. We want our community to grow. So please tell your friends and follow us on Instagram. Thanks also to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, ADCA, and BDC. So, Vicky, you were very active in the Obama for America campaign to elect and then re-elect President Obama. Take us back to those exciting days in the first campaign.
Sure. I'll take you right back there. We first met our then Senator Obama in 2006 at a very small dinner party. There were about 10 of us, and I had the opportunity and privilege of sitting next to the senator. He had just written his book and had most recently given his speech about no red states, no blue states, but the United States of America. And his vision that he articulated for our country was ours and was mine. I had done a lot of work in children's health and education as a philanthropic leader and organizer. And I was very disturbed that so many youth and so many kids and adults in our country did not have appropriate health care at that time. Education has always been a challenge and continue to be a challenge. I listened to Senator Obama's ideas and I thought this man should and could potentially be president. And if he ever throws his hat in the ring, I'm in. Well, sure enough, that night in 2007 of February, we were in a small apartment here in Chicago with about 70 other individuals. He announced his candidacy for president, and we gathered in a room with the very hopeful thought that possibly Barack Hussein Obama could become president of our country. We worked really hard, fundraising and friend-raising and knocking on doors for the president during the first campaign. That campaign and the message we delivered really was inclusive and forward-looking and filled with hope. People joined our campaign of all different ages, races, ethnicities. It was really an amazing family of individuals coming together from all across our country. And then that magical night, after lots of hard work in Grant Park in November of 2008, the park was filled with people, probably 200,000 people on a warm, balmy November night. And we we're cheering our new president, Barack Hussein Obama, in 2008. And I'll never, ever, as long as I live, forget the way that that felt. And the work then began and carried on through two terms with Barack Obama as president.
So exciting. And then
it was.
Yeah. And at that time, too, you were also the Chicago, this is 07, 08, you were the Chicago co-chair for the DNC Women's Leadership Forum, organizing female engagement in politics. So to you, why is it so important to have more women in politics?
Women provide a distinct perspective, I think, oftentimes that maybe men don't. And I think the way in which women lead in a very collaborative way, the way in which women empathize with others, the way in which women multitask, the way in which women articulate themselves and bring ideas and thoughts to the table that might not otherwise be heard are critically important to leadership. And, you know, after all, in the United States, you know, women represent 51-52% of the population, and our representation in our government, you know, is in the low 20s. So we feel that, I just feel it's really important to have more balanced representation, you know, more broad reaching ideas and a different approach. When we organized the Women for Obama effort back in 2007 and 8, it was really around the notion of building different constituencies of support for the president. So we had Women for Obama, Tech for Obama, Environmentalists for Obama, Latinos for Obama. And we built the campaign really by talking directly to individual constituency groups about the issues and the things that they were concerned about most. And you know, we all know that when you activate women and you get women involved, the job is done. So I think by, you know, getting that structure together for Women for Obama, a lot of leadership in terms of organizing and fundraising and fundraising was really born out of that organization. And it was a national organization. So we brought women together really from all across the country as part of the Women for Obama effort.
So here in Canada, we have great representation, I should say, at a federal level. It can, however, be hard for women to be in politics. And so if I look at our own Minister Catherine McKenna as an example, she's regularly targeted on social media. Mm-hmm. And she said recently that, you know, because she has kids on social media and she knows that the kind of harsh attacks affect other women who may want to get into politics, this idea that we actually have to do better. What are your thoughts?
So I think that's a very unfortunate part of the social media space that we live in. People are so unfortunately open with their harsh and unflattering and sometimes humiliating and unfortunate commentary. I think that, you know, in my own situation, it's times when I've been in positions of leadership and using, you know, our social media platform to lead, oftentimes you'll get backlash like that. My modus operandi really has kind of just been to overlook it and to look forward and look ahead. But it's unfortunate because it can really be deeply hurtful, not only to you personally, but to your extended family. I don't know that there's any really easy way to deal with that other than to unfollow or delete the person and move on and just keep talking about the positive things that you're working on and the work that you're doing that's really helping folks. I mean, I think that oftentimes those voices are the minority, but because of the platform, they're out there in the space and visible, and it's unfortunately really, really destructive. So, I mean, we're going to probably have to have some kind of a systematic change or some kind of a sociological change in the way people behave to eradicate that. And I wish I had the answer on the best way to abate that. And maybe that answer is coming, but I don't know if that answer can come from me.
Well, when you and your husband, former USA Ambassador to Canada, Bruce Hayman, were in Ottawa, it was a very fun time. You hosted so many amazing parties and events. I still have a tote bag from your Kentucky Derby party.
So that was fun.
That was so fun. Tell us about
it was
the beautiful residence, Lornado.
Sure. Oh my. Well, Lornado is the most extraordinary stone manor house that sits in Rockcliffe in Ottawa on about 10 acres of beautiful property overlooking the Ottawa and Gatineau River. You see the sunset from the back windows of Lornado each night right over the river, and the way the sky turns colors and the way in which this home sits majestically over the water is just forever memorable. The house is large. It's about 32 rooms. There's a staff that has been employed at the house to maintain and run the house. Many of the staff have been there over 20, 25 years. And that house really is loved and beloved by the staff that work there. They're incredibly warm and generous and loving people. The house is what I say probably the front door of the United States. Uh-huh. maybe even more so than the embassy, to the folks that come through the door and to the folks in Ottawa. And I'll say that because during our tenure, between our 4th of July celebrations and the numerous events that we host in the house, whether it be salons or art gatherings or commerce gatherings or dinner parties, we most have hosted well over 10,000 people in our home. So it was really an open door, and it provides an open door to bring together people of all different industries, really all different locations across Canada when possible. And the events that we hosted were varied. And for me, I took a very special interest in art and culture mm-hmm. as a way to bring people together. So we filled our home with our personal art, some challenging art as well, art that dealt with issues of identity and social justice and race, environment, from some of the most iconic American artists and Canadian artists. And we gathered people oftentimes in a salon experience around the art, delving more deeply into the issues that really connect us as humans, and using the residence really as a place to convene people to talk about these connective tissues, the things that connect our two countries in terms of shared values. So that's one way in which we used kind of the events to push forward, you know, kind of a connected agenda for the United States, but also an agenda that I think Canadians responded to and connected with. So the events vary. They could be some of the salons we spoke about. We could talk a little bit about the fun derby party that you attended. I'm a Kentuckian, and I thought it would be fun culturally to bring a little bit of Kentucky to Ottawa. So we hosted a really fun derby event first weekend in May, which is a derby in Kentucky. And we had Ottawans and actually people from all over the country mm-hmm. of Canada we invited show up with their hats on. We had horses and RCMP officers in red shirt riding around on the front lawn. We did some horse picking. We had some Kentucky Derby mint juleps.
Mm-hmm. I do recall those.
We celebrated in song. Yes, called those and celebrated in song. So you my old Kentucky home and Oh Canada and you name it. And just a lot of love and a lot of warmth and really just connecting to each other through our traditions, which is pretty great. So, you know, the residence was used culturally, it was used to bring about thought leadership. And also we used the residents to really make a statement about environment. I became a beekeeper.
Yes, a beekeeper.
In Ottawa,
I do recall.
On the residence, we had two beehives, which became an apiary with over 100,000 bees. We had an amazing bounty of honey our first year with the bees, over 200 pounds of honey that was created from this incredible hive, and also some sustainable gardens, which we refurbished and increased in size. And our residence property was actually named a wildlife refuge during our tenure. So lots of incredible wildlife, deer and fox and many different kinds of birds and other small wildlife. So it just, you know, going outside in the yard really was even to be a little bit of a mini wildlife adventure. So lots of great things to say about the residence and the opportunities it provides for the people that live there and the people that visit there.
Oh my goodness. And your 4th of July party is at that time was always a must attend, the hottest ticket in the city.
So super fun.
Yeah. You're an amazing host. And
thank you.
Well, it's true though. So let's talk about your new book, The Art of Diplomacy, that you co-wrote mm-hmm. with your husband, again, former Ambassador Bruce Hayman. So tell us about the book and why you wrote it. It's certainly very timely. Why does diplomacy matter more than ever today, Vicki?
Well, you know, The Art of Diplomacy, the title actually was born out of the idea that diplomacy is not I win, you lose art of the deal endeavor. It is a win-win endeavor where through, you know, even times where you may have some disagreements, not being disagreeable, finding outcomes that are mutually beneficial to both people in the relationship. Not an I win, you lose, but a win-win. The Art of Diplomacy, our book that we wrote, really talks about and gives the reader an opportunity to travel with us throughout Canada and really meet Canadians from all across your country that became our teachers and who brought us into their communities and into their homes and let us understand at a deep level what Canadians care about, who Canadians are, and how they live in their communities. So you'll travel with us in the book all the way from, you know, Peggy's Cove, Nova Scotia, mm-hmm. to the Delaney people in the North Arctic, to Tuktoyaktuk, to Vancouver, to Quebec. You'll meet artists, actually out west as well. You'll meet artists, you'll meet thought leaders, you'll meet Supreme Court justices, prime ministers, business people, small business folk, restaurants, RCMP officers. So it's a broad picture of Canadians and our interactions with them. And also in terms of the Art of Diplomacy, we talk about the way in which we use art and culture to build bridges between our two countries and the people, you know, that we engage. So you'll also spend time understanding and reading about many of the encounters we had between Canadians and the American artists that we brought to Canada, and kind of what we learned from each other in our discussions through the art about the issues we spoke about earlier of, you know, identity and race, social justice,
yes.
environment, you know, those kinds of issues. So you're going to really get, I think, a very good idea of our journey, our travels, some of the fun and zany things that happened, some of the challenging aspects of our journey, and then really talking about showing, kind of not telling, about what diplomacy should really look like. I mean, in our current, at the current time, you know, the relationship between Canada is being stressed, and the leadership, you know, our current president Trump has been in his style of leadership and the manner in which he engages has been stressing the relationship. So we want Canadians to really get an idea of, you know, how much we do care about the relationship. And we want Americans to understand, you know, on this side of the border when reading the book, just how important the relationship is, and understand at a deeper level who Canadians are. Oftentimes as Americans, we kind of look inward and look down, not always look out. And so we think that the book and kind of the portrayal that we present can let Americans, when reading a book, have a bit of a front seat and a closer window into the Canadian hearts and minds.
I know President Obama once said that the world needs more Canada. So why do you think the world needs more Canada?
Because you guys have... Okay, so let's take this back. I would say, and there's so many things that we as Americans and the country can learn from you as Canadians. I think there is a deep feeling of I am my brother's keeper in terms of the Canadian community and how you care for each other. There's a social safety net as it relates to health care. I think that, you know, there is a handle on in a way of controlling the gun situation that we can learn from in our own country. I think that there is an opportunity in Canada for more gender equity than there is in the United States. And I think that's something else that we admire and can learn from. I want to say that there's many ways in which Americans could benefit from some of the really optimal things that Canada has brought forward in your own day-to-day.
So what was
your own government society.
Thank you. What was the experience like writing the book together with your husband? How was that?
Well, there were days, you know, where we were kind of like, okay, another day downstairs on the lower level, you know, in our sweats, editing through things. We were very excited about the possibility to do this because it's a great capstone to our time. But we also felt that it was the right time to write this book and to have these discussions with both Canadians and Americans about the importance of the relationship. You know, I would say from the conceptualization of the book and the storytelling, at least kind of blocking out the stories, there are countless hours and hours and hours of us recounting and telling and recording our stories and then trying to figure out what to include and what not to include. And we wanted the book to really be narrated in both of our voices, but our stories are combined. So in my chapter, when I'm talking about, you know, the artist Eric Fischel and his experience, our experience with him coming to Canada, Bruce's dialogue and some of Bruce's experience are present in those chapters. So it wasn't like I wrote a chapter and Bruce wrote one. We really wrote it together. And then there was just editing and editing and editing and endless editing.
Yes.
We included a lot of photographs in the book, so selecting the correct photographs that would tell the stories. It was an incredible learning process. This is the first time we've ever written a book, and certainly the first time we've ever worked on a project like this so closely. At the end of the day, you know, the book is written and we're having a lot of fun on the book tour, talking about the book and learning a lot and some really important conversations. I must say it's been a really incredible journey. And like anything you undertake for the first time, there's a lot of learning that goes on. I think we both become better writers and better storytellers, and publishing is hard, man. It's not the easiest thing to do. I mean, I think one thing is, you know, we had a really great publisher, Simon & Schuster, and a great writer collaborator and editor as well that worked closely with us. But it's a tough thing to write a book is one thing. Then you actually get the book into the world and to have other people read it and to have, you know, kind of some virality to the book where the conversations get bigger and bigger. I mean, I feel like writing the book is really only one part of the process. It's like once you've written it and you do the tour and the roadshow and talk about it, it's like what kind of action can emanate from the book. So for us, writing the book is probably step one, and touring the book is step two, but the call to action for the book is probably the most important part, which is the book really ends with a call to action for all of us to use the art of diplomacy on both sides of the border as citizen ambassadors for the relationship. So as we tour with the book and we have these really important conversations, the fun conversations about the people we met, but also the important conversations about where do we go from here and how do we keep this relationship as strong as it's always been, it really involves individuals across border, you know, reaching out to and connecting Americans and Canadians in whatever industry or passion or purpose you're engaged in. And it also involves political engagement. You know, it involves Americans living in Canada who are eligible to vote, to get into the voting process. It is a call to action for Americans to engage in the voting process, the political process, to elect the leaders they think were going to be the best for this kind of vision of America and Canada and the relationship. So that's what we've been talking a lot about on the tour, is how to really put up, how to put forward structures and ideas and mechanisms and ways for people to engage, you know, person to person.
Very timely book. Very timely.
Yeah.
Take us back, Vicki, to the 10-year-old you. What was that girl like? Were you living in Kentucky at that time?
Yeah, I'm a small-town girl. I grew up in Ashland, Kentucky. It's a small-town in eastern Kentucky. The third largest city in Kentucky, but small, and in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. It was an industrial town where oil and steel and oil refining was the main industry, so more of a blue-collar town. My parents and grandparents were small-town retailers. They came, like a lot of Eastern European Jews, to small southern towns, and they set up mom and pop small department stores where they started making their livelihood. And our family business was a multi-generational retail department store. My great-grandpa started it, then my grandfather. My parents were involved, and my sister and brother and I started working in the business, not quite at 10, but maybe at 12, you know, wrapping yep. presents at the holiday time. I worked a lot as a kid in our store, and I think, honestly, that experience of dealing directly with customers and people in our community in a a direct way to the young child. I think that gave me a lot of confidence in my abilities to express myself, to make the proverbial sale, should they say. And I came from a really wonderful, close, very lucky person, loving family that I think gave my siblings and I a great foundation. We all left Kentucky after going to university. We never really returned to our home, but the store carried on probably until about, maybe 25 years ago. It was a 70-year-old operating business.
Amazing.
And it was always like another member of our family. It was like the fourth child. So it was very present in our lives. I think as a 10-year-old, I am the oldest child, so to be a bit bossy, I guess.
That's called leadership, style. Vicki. I think we call that leadership.
Yeah, leadership. I was extreme leader of the family, of the siblings, I guess I would say, because of the age and personality. I was always a joiner. And I've always been a person that saw the glass half full, not half empty. And I think I've always used probably... soft skills as a leader. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily identify myself as that person, like, you know, leading the parade or marching down the street, follow me. I think that I led in particularly the areas of things that I was really interested in. And my number one passion, probably from the time I was 10 to the time I'm now, I think, is my passion and curiosity for people. So I've always been very interested in people and their stories and figuring out ways of engaging with them, but also connecting them to others. And I think even as a little kid, I probably unconsciously did that by the groups I would gather together, the clubs I would join. And I always I've always tried to be a leader by more inclusivity and getting others to kind of come into the group. And I think that probably started also when I was a younger child.
And you did, you mentioned that you left Kentucky to go to school. So you did your undergrad and then your MBA. Were there many women studying business with you at that time?
You know, I would say, looking back on that, it was an interesting experience how it happened because I'd gone to Vanderbilt University as an undergrad. I graduated from Vanderbilt. I was a senior at university in my last year, and it was the first semester, and I was taking a class in finance. I never really considered myself, you know, like a great finance student, but for some reason I'd done okay in this class. I had not considered business school, but this professor said to me, "Hey, why don't you consider, you're great in my class, why don't you consider applying to this business school program? It's what they call 1.5 year program where you could enter business school early and get your MBA in a year." And I thought, wow, that's not a bad idea. I kind of did that more in terms of a second thought. Originally, I thought maybe I would complete school and possibly go work or apply to law school. I applied to this business school program really kind of just out of happenstance, with the professor asked me to consider it. And when I got into the business school, it was a very nascent program. I actually had only been around a few years. And Bruce was also in the same program with me. Mm-hmm. And our very first class we signed up for, I heard he was in the class, we were both undergrads at Vanderbilt together, was a class in new venture creation, entrepreneurship. And I heard that you got graded as a dyad. In other words, you know, one grade for two people in their participation. So I turned to Bruce and I said, "Bruce, I heard of this class at the Owen School and I hear you're going. You get graded as a dyad. With your brains and my creativity, I think we can get an A. You want to sign up with me?" Well, sure enough, he signed up. We got the A, and about 8 months later, we were engaged.
Aww.
So in terms of that's how the love story was born. But in terms of our being a female in business school, maybe 20% of the class was women at that point. And it was not, I guess in a way, it was just, it was early on. And many of the careers that came out of the business school were more male dominated. For example, when I graduated from business school, I went to work on Wall Street at Bankers Trust Company in foreign currency sales and trading. And in terms of female leadership or female employment on the floor in a professional capacity, it was probably much less than 20%. It might have even been 10% of the professional women, professional people at that point in the 1980s were women. So, you know, I think women were there and they were equally as good students. And in the business school environment, you felt very much part of a community. But I think as you did different kind of career endeavors, many of the careers, particularly in finance, were very underweighted with women. And on those early days, that was probably a challenge. I mean, that was a bit of a challenge, I would say, for me, and even more of a challenge, I think, you know, depending upon the exact space that you were hired in.
It is no surprise that you two have written this amazing book, The Art of Diplomacy, because you've been a dynamic duo all the way since your MBA days. So final question, Vicki, and it's a three-parter. So what's your dream for Canada? What's your dream for the USA? And as if that isn't enough, what about your dream for the world?
This is a very, I think, a big question. And I think my answer is a lofty one. And my dream for Canada, for the United States, and the world is really is unity. It's peace. It's prosperity. And it's really about building bridges between our communities, not walls. And deepening this deep abiding friendship that we have between our two countries and extending all that goodness into the world. I have to be an optimist about the future because I meet so many extraordinary people in both of our countries and really in our global travels. And I know that at the heart of each individual, this is truly what they want. And this is what, you know, really keeps us essentially alive. Is these friendships and the, you know, the openness in which we can communicate with each other, you know, in a shared vision for a really extraordinary world that we know can be ours. So that's truthfully is my dream, and I'm going to keep working on that dream and, you know, just keep connecting to, I think, the individuals that can make that happen.
It's a beautiful dream for both of our countries and for the world. Vicki Hayman, you are so inspiring. This has been an amazing conversation. You're a philanthropist, you're a community activist, you certainly are a very influential American cultural representative, and the author of this just released really exciting book, The Art of Diplomacy. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Fearless Women podcast, Vicki. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll talk soon. Bye now.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club Canada for your support of the Fearless Women Podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management not only encourages better leadership and governance, but diversity further contributes to better all-around board performance and ultimately increased corporate performance for both companies and their shareholders. Want to learn more? Visit their website, 30percentclub.org, and select the Canada chapter to find out about membership, supporters, and key resources. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.